stick on it, check on it, stick on it. Help, help.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. While it may not appear to be the case on your end of this podcast, I've actually been spending a lot of time in the salon this week. To begin with, I recorded the interview with Charlie Grobe that you're about to hear. And on Tuesday, I drove up to Long Beach to spend the day with Gary Fisher, looking at his pictures and poking through his files and recording some of his stories. And if you don't know who Gary is, you can learn something about him and his psychedelic research in next week's podcast. But today I'm going to play the recording of a conversation I had with Dr. Charles Grobe, M.D., or Charlie as he prefers to be called. Charlie is a professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the UCLA School of Medicine and director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. He conducted the first government-approved study of MDMA and, along with Dennis McKenna and Jace Calloway, conducted an international biomedical psychiatric research project in the Brazilian Amazon, which focused on ayahuasca use. He is currently conducting an investigation of the effects of psilocybin with end-stage cancer patients. And Charlie's published numerous articles in medical and psychiatric journals and collected volumes, and he's also the editor of Hallucinogens, a reader, and along with Roger Walsh, he edited Higher Wisdom, Eminent Elders Explore the Continuing Impact of Psychedelics. Charlie is also a founding board member of the Hefter Research Institute, and for full disclosure, I probably should add that Charlie is also a very close friend of Mary C's and mine. So why don't you just sit back, relax, and join Charlie and me here in the Psychedelic Salon. What I thought we'd do is we'd talk about your MDMA study and the psilocybin study, and just briefly touch on the ayahuasca thing, because that one will bring in Dennis and Jace and get the three of you talking.
Okay, sure.
So, well, let me just kind of start off and say that, as far as I know, aren't you about the only, at least U.S. researcher who's actually done human studies with three different psychoactive compounds on human tests? Am I correct that there?
Possibly. There are so few investigators in this area that might be possible. I'd have to give it some thought.
Yeah, I haven't come across anybody else. And as I recall the story, you went into medicine and went through the whole rigors of medical school because you wanted to do this research. Am I right about that?
No, that's correct. Back in the early 70s, I had an epiphany that what I wanted to do was to conduct psychiatric research with psychedelic drugs, and here we are some 35 plus years later, and it turns out that I've been able to do that.
But as the people that know you know, it hasn't been easy. It's taken a long time to get these studies going, right?
Oh, it took a very long time. Back in the early 70s, I very naively thought that by the time I left medical school, but at the end of the 70s, I'd be able to join somebody's ongoing psychedelic research project. But by then, of course, everything had been shut down. And nothing opened up for a number of years, not until the 90s, when Rick Straussman was the first one to demonstrate that it was still possible to get approval to conduct a phase one investigation, in his case with DMT. About a year after that, I was able to get permission to work with MDMA in normal volunteers.
Now, what did it take to, you say you got permission to do it, but it wasn't quite that simple. What all was involved? I assume even that you started before about the same time Rick was starting to get his approvals.
Back around 1990, 91, I wrote up, with the help of some colleagues, I wrote up my first protocol, and then it was a matter of submitting to FDA, and that process took some time. It went back and forth. I was, in fact, invited to Washington, actually to Rockville, Maryland, to testify at a hearing conducted at the FDA examining the merits of doing human research with MDMA. They invited a number of experts from around the country, and I was there, and I think it had a fairly good outcome. At that point, I had put in a protocol asking to work with a patient population, and their response was that we were a little ahead of the game by wanting to work with patients, that we would first have to conduct a study with normal volunteers and establish safety parameters there. And so I was happy to rewrite a protocol for normal volunteers. Initially, I had questioned whether they would even allow that because of the so-called neurotoxicity issue, which at least back at that time had questioned whether the drug would be safe for anyone to take at any time under any circumstance. But I thought the FDA hearing went well, and I thought the people in charge were quite fair and judicious, and they did encourage us to take it back to the drawing board and bring back to them a normal volunteer protocol, which we did, and then that was approved in November 92.
So you actually began your submission of your protocol back during the Reagan administration, is that right?
No, it would be the Bush 1.
Oh, Bush 1, okay.
Right, Bush 1.
Still not necessarily a drug-friendly regime.
No, not at all. And actually, I'll add that I had been told over the phone in the early autumn of 92 that we had permission. I asked for something in writing, which I needed for our hospital committees, but I did not get anything in writing until the day after Election Day in 92.
Huh.
So I don't know if that was coincidence or someone up there in the bureaucracy was waiting to see how the new political realities would play out, but that's what happened.
That's an interesting coincidence, anyhow. And first of all, let me clarify that we're talking about MDMA, which on the street a lot of people call ecstasy, but most of what they find on the street today under ecstasy is probably not MDMA. Is at least a lot of it. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. Correct. My interest was always in studying the potential therapeutic effects of MDMA. I've always had concerns about use and abuse of the recreational drug ecstasy. Now, early on in the history of this drug, ecstasy was almost always MDMA, but over the years there's been more and more drug substitution to the point where now there's with ecstasy, I think there's less reliability in regards to it being the drug you think it is, and any other drug that I'm aware of. Many surveys show that more than 50% of what's sold out there on the streets is ecstasy. It turns out to be a drug other than MDMA.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. It's quite sad. That's one of the problems of prohibition, of course, is you don't know what you're getting out on the street. So we'll get back into the clinical area here. That, as you mentioned, the psychological properties of these materials are quite interesting. And before it hit the streets, as most people now know, Leo Zeff trained a bunch of people like George Greer and Requa Talbert were two of the people he trained. Did you ever get to meet the secret chief and talk to him?
I've heard many stories about him, but when he was active, I was actually living on the East Coast, and by the time I got out here and had developed some interest in that area, Leo Zeff had essentially exited the stage. I never got to meet him.
I guess we ought to go through the process of getting approval for doing this so that some of our listeners can kind of go through the pain and agony. But when you write a protocol, you just don't sit there by yourself and make up, hey, I want to do this. You consult with colleagues. And then how does the process work before it even gets to, say, the FDA?
Well, at first you want to come up with a good effort. I mean, I'll start off the process, and then I'll send my draft to colleagues who have some expertise in this area and some background with research protocols and the regulatory process. And there's a lot of back and forth, and I pool ideas from a variety of sources, and then I essentially complete the best protocol I can come up with all the input I get, after which I submit to the federal regulatory agencies, starting with the FDA.
Now, at that point, do you have money lined up for a study, or is this your
No. No, every study I've ever run has been run on a shoestring, and but essentially, I've always had the approach that one saw in the old movie. I think it was called Field of Dreams, you know, where Kevin Costner is building a baseball field for the great old stars to come and play at, and he says, "If I build it, they will come." So I've always felt if I can get a protocol written that competently addresses the issues at hand, and if I can get it approved by all the regulatory agencies and hospital committees, that the funding will arrive. And it always has, although I will add, not very much. And we tend to run very lean budgets, especially compared to other kinds of medical and psychiatric drug research budgets.
Yeah, that's always a problem, is that you're almost like a U.S. politician out there begging for money more time than actually doing your work sometimes, it seems like.
But it's been challenging, although I will say that we've had a few people who have been invaluable in helping us get off the ground and keep our momentum going. And so we have had a few people who've made very important contributions.
Now, when you have a protocol into the FDA, they look at it and they come back and say, well, we don't like this or that or the other
thing. Right. So there was a lot of back and forth with actually every regulatory agency and every committee we went through. And I thought their input was often, right on the mark, and they gave us some helpful recommendations. So we modified our protocol further going through the regulatory process.
Well, let's go ahead and just take this process in a generic sense, because the most recent one probably is the psilocybin study, and that would be the most current information as to how it happens.
Right, also most currently in my memory. This is from some time ago. So with psilocybin, we went through the same kind of process. And here we had, we were asking for permission to work with advanced stage cancer patients, and we put in for permission to work with a fairly high dose, 0.3 milligram per kilogram. And the FDA got back to us and said they thought, given this was the first time in many years this kind of patient population was going to be studied with a psychedelic drug, that they thought the first study should approach it more cautiously with a modest dose. So after some discussion and consideration, I accepted that this was actually good advice. So here we are establishing our treatment process and establishing feasibility that we could actually get this work done, and also looking to establish safety parameters. So starting with a more modest dose, I felt did make sense. So we rewrote the protocol, and one thing we changed was the dose, which was 0.2 milligram per kilogram. And I've actually felt that, although I will, in the not-too-distant future, resubmit, as we're finishing our pilot study, and I'll resubmit to do a larger scale study, I will apply for a higher dose. I think it was a good idea to have done the pilot investigation with the more modest dose. We've had some good results even with that.
Now, once you get FDA approval, it's not over there, though.
Not at all. No, we have to go through the DEA, and that involves a visit from a local DEA agent who really is primarily concerned with the security of the drug. So he wants to see where it is stored and how secure that arrangement is. And you have to have a special safe that meets specifications to store Schedule I drugs, and it has to be within a locked room, and that locked room has to be within another locked room, and so they've got fairly clear specifications as to what needs to be accomplished before they allow you permission to store the drug. But we got through that all right as well. And then after the FDA and after the DEA, we went through the California has its own in-state regulatory committee. It's kind of like an in-state FDA or in-state review for Schedule I research, and that's the California Research Advisory Panel. And they also made some comments, and they had some good input as well, and we did some further modifications. And then we had to go through two hospital committees at Harbor UCLA. One was the IRB, or the Human Subjects Committee, and the other is the research committee that oversees all research on the research unit, which is where we conduct our study.
Now, if one of those organizations makes some changes, do you have to go all the way back to the FDA and start over again?
Well, you submit your final version.
Ah.
Although no changes were made in any of the areas that each of the prior committees had been emphatic that we ought to make some modifications. And by the end, all the regulatory groups seem more comfortable with the final version.
You know, some of the people who I know are grad students and medical students that are thinking about this as an area of work for their life's work probably ought to keep in mind the fact that the glory part, where you're actually working with a participant who's on using the substance, those hours are pretty minimal compared to all of the bureaucratic hours,
well,
right?
It takes a long time before you get to that point of actually treating somebody. So if you have some ambition to work in this area, you have to develop a certain character qualities, like having a lot of patience and persistence.
Two things that would eliminate me from doing psychedelic research, I can assure you, that you've exhibited a great deal of that over the years. I know it took, for your psilocybin study, it took quite a few years to get that approved, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the first version was actually our first protocol we sent to FDA back in 91, I think, and it was actually written for MDMA, though we initially thought of using MDMA for a patient population with advanced cancer. But then because of the turmoil in our culture with the ecstasy fad and the questions over central nervous system damage, and really just how sensationalized it had become, we felt it would be very hard to get permission in that political environment. So we rewrote the protocol in the late 90s for psilocybin. And I'll say that that decision was made in concert with my colleagues at the Hefter Research Institute, who strongly urged me to resubmit a cancer treatment protocol, but substituting psilocybin for MDMA.
Just since there has really not been a study that I know about MDMA and cancer, but you are working right now with cancer patients and psilocybin, I know there's no way you can have a professional opinion, but your gut reaction right now about the two different substances for somebody that's in end-stage cancer, which do you think is preferable?
Sure. No, I've actually given this some thought, and I've come to the determination that psilocybin, I believe, would be a safer, possibly more efficacious drug to use. One reason being that with MDMA, what we observed and what others have observed is even with normal volunteers, you can get some very, very robust blood pressure changes. You can get some very significant increases in blood pressure after you administer MDMA. And my view is that with people who had advanced cancer, they very well may have multiple organ system failures, and they may have a very vulnerable cardiovascular system, and a rapid precipitous rise in blood pressure may lead to catastrophic consequences. We felt psilocybin with much more modest effects on cardiovascular function would be a safer compound to use in that regard.
And your phase one study is about safety, so you are measuring blood pressure, those kind of things, right?
Right, absolutely. Now we do throughout the experimental treatment session, but another consideration is that many people after an MDMA session report in subsequent days a tremendous drain of energy, and given the precarious status of people with advanced cancer, we felt that could be problematic as well. That, in a sense, we're not only looking for, helping to facilitate a very positive experience during the, 4 to 6 hours of the acute drug effects. But we're also hoping here, or even speculating, that this treatment model will facilitate significant improvements in psychiatric status in the subsequent days, weeks, and even months. And if you're wrestling with tremendous energy drain, it may detract from the to what degree you can come away from that experience with an overall improvement in your psychological status. We felt psilocybin would, generally after a psilocybin session, people do not feel that energy drain they do with MDMA, likely from the amphetamine quality of the MDMA, that people feel very, very good, very grounded, and do not feel physically and psychologically exhausted, as you not infrequently see with MDMA. So there were a few reasons why we felt psilocybin would be a preferable compound to use in with this kind of patient population. Also,
right,
perhaps that it it provides, we thought, perhaps a more in-depth experience, an experience that might allow one to explore more the existential dimensions of their current life situation.
Yeah, I can confess to in my past days having experimented with both of these substances, and I found that the psilocybin gave me a cosmic experience, where the MDMA gave me more of a grounded empathy contact with other human experience.
Right. Well, yeah, and what I'm saying doesn't necessarily, I'm not saying that MDMA does not have its place within with various therapeutic approaches with particular patient groups. I'm just saying that people with very, very severe end-stage medical illness may not be the optimal population for a drug like MDMA. On the other hand, for instance, a group of patients with chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, such as what Michael Mithoffer is working with in South Carolina, that might be an ideal population. Presumably these people are physically healthy. The MDMA might induce a very profound state, a pathogenic state, and also a state where they feel safe enough to explore with the therapist the prior trauma and to start to work through much of the issues and the, in a sense, the psychic armoring that grew up in response to that trauma. So MDMA might turn out to be a very valuable compound to use with a chronic PTSD patient group. But with a medically ill group, I over the years, I started to question that and felt that psilocybin would be significantly safer.
In your research that you did in the early 90s with humans and MDMA, which we knew was pure MDMA, what kind of, did you have any negative or adverse results? Was everybody the same or what?
Well, we treated, I'll tell you a couple of stories. Well, one is that we had two people who had very significant hypertensive reactions. One was our oldest subject, who was, I believe, around 60. He had normal baseline blood pressure, and within an hour, his systolic blood pressure had gone up to 200, which certainly concerned myself and my research nurse. But we actually treated it, and it went rapidly down. And then we had another man, a 27-year-old, and here he was coming in for his third treatment session. And with that study, people came in for three separate experimental treatment sessions spaced several weeks apart. Two were different dosages of MDMA. One was a placebo. It was his third session, so we knew that he had received MDMA on at least one other occasion. It was all double-blinded as well, so we didn't actually know what they were getting on each occasion. But on the third occasion, he's had it at least once before. Well, after an hour, his blood pressure went from a systolic of 120 up to 220. When I looked at the record, he had had pretty normal blood pressure through his other two sessions. So I asked him, well, something's got to be different today than was the case on your previous visits. And he said, yeah, there was something different. He had not he had decided not to tell me because he didn't think it was important, but now he was going to reveal it. And that was that in order to get to the hospital early in the morning, as we were requiring, he had stayed at a friend's house who lives close to the hospital. His friend had a cat. The subject turned out to be allergic to the cat and started to develop some wheezing. Had some breathing difficulty. So his friend said, well, you know, I have some asthma medicine perhaps you could try that could help your wheezing. So he took some of his friend's asthma medicine, and it turns out that the interaction between the asthma medicine and the MDMA caused a fairly serious blood pressure elevation. So we rapidly treated it. We brought it back down to normal, but it also points out a relative risk in regards to recreational use of MDMA is that a lot of people are oblivious to the fact that different drugs can interact with one another, and people who may have medical conditions on medication who then take ecstasy, you know, which is some often, though not always, MDMA, that there may be a drug-drug interaction which can cause injurious effect. So it's kind of a cautionary note in regards to the use of both the recreational and the controlled sanctioned therapeutic use of MDMA.
You know, that's a really good point, one I forget to make sometimes. I know there's so many people at raves and parties and gatherings that are doing polydrugging, which,
right.
You know, it's one thing if it's something that's, you know, tried and true and thousands have done it and you know what the results are, but what a lot of people forget is just these common over-the-counter medicines are going to interact.
Oh, that's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You take a cold medicine with some pseudoephedrine in it, and you can cause some cardiovascular symptoms, including a hypertensive episode. You know, there are other examples in the literature. For instance, some years ago, a report from San Francisco General Hospital of a man who was being treated for HIV disorder with a protease inhibitor. He came in looking as if he had taken an overdose of ecstasy or MDMA, and he alleged to have taken only one pill. And after some investigation, the treating physicians realized that the protease inhibitor which he was taking had impaired the capacity of this man's liver to metabolize the MDMA. So he was not clearing the MDMA and was left with a rather alarming situation with, you know, high blood pressure and palpitations and the like. He eventually was able to clear the drug and was left the hospital healthy, but it was it caused some alarm among the treating personnel for a while.
And of course, that adds to the records and the literature saying, "Oh, here's another emergency room victim of MDMA," which of course it was, but it's complicated because of other substances. So
that's right.
Did you in that first study? Did you have anybody that just absolutely had a horrible trip or a bad trip?
Oh, good. I'm glad you asked that. Okay, so we were one of our subjects comes in for his first session, and he becomes acutely anxious, quite agitated, and told me that he was very upset that he had volunteered for the study, that he felt taking a drug like, he called it ecstasy, allowed him to pick up all of the, as he put it, negative vibes in the hospital, and it was distressing him. So, you know, I told him that according to what he had agreed to, he needed to stay in the hospital for the rest of the day and through the night. But in the morning, he could leave, and he did not have to come back for the following two sessions. And in a sense, he could elect, after he left the hospital, to drop out of the study, which he did. Now, following his dropping out of the study, we decided to break the blind to see how much MDMA we had given him that had caused this fairly serious anxiety reaction. So we broke the blind, and to our surprise, it turned out that he had received a placebo. So the take-home message there is never underestimate the power of the placebo response. So essentially, he had simply psyched himself out. Now, that being said, we had 18 subjects who received MDMA on two occasions. none had an adverse psychological experience. They all had positive psychological experiences and tolerated being in the hospital without a problem.
So I guess my Irish comment would be, beware the placebos.
right.
Now, you had a range of people there. You said somebody was near 60 and
right.
somebody 27. So was there any difference in the physiological reactions in the age group, or is it pretty much...
I think the lesson from the 60-year-old was that as we get older... We tend to have somewhat more vulnerability in our cardiovascular responses. So, I'd have to say most of our subjects were on the young side, but our older ones, no one had a hypertensive reaction like the 60-year-old man, but we had a couple of others who had, some elevations of blood pressure. But it was the 60-year-old who seemed to have, just came into that session with significant vulnerability to experience just what happened.
Well, one of the reasons I asked that is I read about the brain development and that it's still going on while we're in our teenage years and all, and then of course there's all these rumors about Suicide Tuesdays coming down off of MDMA, and
right.
I was just wondering about the relative merits of what do you tell your kids other than just say no, because there are some risks, some dangers. It's hard to protect a child, and yet you don't want to just say no, because some of these things can be also very positive materials,
right.
as well.
That's a very tricky issue. You're right, just sweeping prohibitions often are not effective. I think often the most helpful thing you could do is simply to be honest and to provide young people with the information that we know to date. For instance, caution them that when they purchase ecstasy, that there's a great possibility that it may be a drug other than ecstasy, and then to describe to them what some of these other drugs might be, and some might be fairly toxic and dangerous to users. I think we should also talk to them about the danger of mixing medications or mixing these kinds of compounds with other recreational drugs, as well as medically prescribed medications. I think we also need to talk with them about the setting where it's taken, that in fact it turns out that the most common venue for taking a drug like MDMA is a big dance scene, and we need to let them help them learn that that might be dangerous in and of itself. There have been a number of cases of malignant hyperthermia where people start to heat up so their body temperature can go up to 105, 106 degrees, which can cause a very, very serious blood condition called disseminated intravascular coagulation, or DIC, where blood vessels start to clot off. It could lead to liver failure, it could lead to kidney failure, it could lead to seizures, and there have been deaths reported. Now, these are far more likely to occur in a setting where individuals are exercising, such as dancing at a rave, where it may be crowded and with a stuffy, just crowded, poor ventilation. The ambient temperature may be too warm. Also, there was an example in England of two young men dying on consecutive weekends at the same dance club. When authorities went to investigate, they realized that the establishment was in the practice of turning off the tap water in the bathroom, thereby forcing people to buy water over the counter at the bar for the price of a beer. And here were two young men who died of malignant hyperthermia, and who seemingly were placed at greater risk because of the deprivation of available fluids.
Yeah, you know, it's really a tough call, because I do know how much fun it can be to take that and dance all night, but the young people that I've convinced to give it a try and, you know, back off the dance floor, get together in a small group, and not that I'm advocating this because you legally can't, but I've been thanked many times by people who say, gosh, I never knew it could be so interesting with a group of four or five people and what we learned about each other. And so, you know, that all of these medicines are, you know, it's like anything else. Too much of a good thing can kill
you. Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the ancient Greeks used to like to say that, you know, the difference between a medicine and a poison is the dose. And you might also say that in a case like this, another difference might be the frequency that within which one has the experience and the amount of the drug used. I think one concern I have with MDMA is that a lot of people will report that over time the positive effects attenuate or diminish, so they start to increase the dose, they start to mix it with other drugs, including methamphetamine. And in those kinds of situations, I think there's some implicit dangers.
Right. Most definitely there are.
Well, wouldn't you know it, but right about here, my good old Dell computer crashed. And so I rebooted and called Charlie back, and we talked for about another 10 minutes. And then it crashed again. And that 10 minutes is lost forever, I'm afraid. But I tried one more time, and Charlie was very, very gracious and patient. But we finally did get about another 10 minutes of our conversation recorded, and I'll play that right now.
Okay, well, before we just got so rudely interrupted by the computer crash,
sure.
we were talking about the work Humphrey Osmond did in Saskatchewan with alcoholics, and
sure.
You were talking about that a little bit.
Right, no, Osmond had a fascinating project. He treated with one dose of either high-dose LSD or mescaline. He treated very hardcore, chronic alcoholics who had been refractory or non-responsive to other treatments. And he found that an appreciable proportion were able to maintain sobriety for some time. When he went back to look at what the strongest predictor was for those patients with a positive outcome, he found that these individuals, during their one session, had what was described as a religious or psycho-spiritual or mystical experience, a mystico-mimetic experience, as it were. So we found that those individuals who had this kind of spiritual epiphany were the ones who were able to sustain sobriety for the longest period of time. And this, you know, this kind of harkens back to what William James, the founder of American psychology more than 100 years ago, once said about alcoholism, which he called dipsomania. He said the best treatment for dipsomania is religiomania. And that's also consistent with our observations in Brazil when we did our ayahuasca study with the Onda Vegetal.
I was going to ask about that. Wasn't that also involved with a lot of alcoholics in that study?
Well, a number of the people I interviewed for the study, and just also spoke informally with outside of the study, were people who had fairly serious problems with alcoholism and drug addiction, antisocial behavior prior to their entry into the UDV, where they had access to ayahuasca ceremonies twice monthly. And, these were people who, after their entry into the ayahuasca religion, were able to abandon their destructive use of alcohol and other drugs altogether. So seems to me there are some very interesting implications here for Osmond's old work with alcoholics, as well as some of our more recent observations with the ayahuasca church, as well as others who have observed a similar process with the Native American Peyote Church.
Yeah, you know, it'd be interesting to compare some of Osmond's results with, like, the Peyote Church and the UDV, because they seem to have a monthly reinforcement, whereas the Osmond group didn't sound like he did follow through with them.
That's correct. And I think looking at these religions, organized legal religions that are sanctioned to administer plant psychedelics to their practitioners, that the value of, in a sense, these booster experiences every couple of weeks or every month seem to be quite significant. So I think, honestly, that the ideal model, putting all this together to treat alcoholics, would be an initial treatment program followed by sequential opportunity for follow-up booster sessions. I think that would be far more likely to reinforce the positive effects and create a greater likelihood of extending sobriety.
Well, right now I don't see any real treatments for alcoholism other than, you know, go to a program for every day or something like that.
Well, honestly, if you look with you know, just very openly and honestly at the situation of how we treat alcoholics, I think you'd have to acknowledge that we really haven't advanced much over the last 50 or 60 years. I mean, 50 years ago, if an alcoholic came into your office asking for help, probably you'd suggest that they find a 12-step group, and if they're lucky and if it was a good fit, they could get some help. But if it wasn't a good fit, they might be out of luck. This would be the same kind of treatment approach you might recommend 50 years ago that you might recommend today with an alcoholic. So I think, especially with a condition like this, where there is extraordinary damage done to the individual, to families, to the whole social fabric, and where we have very, very limited effective treatments, where the field of medicine has evolved so minimally over the last half century, I think there's tremendous need and even opportunity here to develop new novel treatment programs involving optimal structures to utilize psychedelics. Of course, that being said, it would have to be done in an entirely legal sanction context.
And you know, I wonder if the times are maybe starting to, the pendulum swinging, because now you just gave a presentation at the American Psychiatric Association talking about psychedelics, which you probably couldn't have done 10 years ago.
Well, actually, I did.
You did, huh?
I've talked at the APA going back to the early 90s. There's always been some interest, but...
So you've been the thorn in their side that long?
Well, I'm a thorn in their side. I think I've been involved with seven or eight applications to the APA to do presentations, about half of which have been accepted. So half the time we're able to give the talk we'd like to, and half the time we get shot down. And generally speaking, we get a fairly good turnout. This year we maybe had about 60 people. Previous years probably had upwards to 100. We're generally given an out-of-the-way location and a suboptimal time slot, but generally we pull in enough people to feel that it's been worthwhile to have made the effort to do it.
Are you finding better acceptance among your colleagues now?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. When I give this talk, there are generally one of two responses. Either people come up afterwards and say, this is really great, it's about time that people started to study these compounds again. That's one kind of response. And the other kind of response was, this isn't very interesting, it has nothing to do with what psychiatry is all about these days, so I'm not going to waste my time here. But we generally don't get the kind of hostile response that I think I had some concern might be the case when I started this years ago.
Well, let's hope that the pendulum is swinging, and I really, you know, we're probably going to have to cut this off, but I really appreciate your time right now, and look forward to talking to you and Dennis and Jace about your ayahuasca research, because that's something that's near and dear to the hearts of a lot of people in the world these days.
Well, thanks a lot for your time today, Charlie, and I look forward to having you join us here in the Psychedelic Salon again. And do you have any parting words you'd like to say to the all of your fans out there in cyberspace?
Be careful, and don't be in such a rush. It's there are fascinating possibilities out there, and sometimes makes a lot of sense to be patient and wait for opportunities that allow for optimal safety and optimal outcome to what you're trying to succeed.
Well, I'll definitely second that. So thank you very much, Charlie.
Okay.
After listening to my conversation with Charlie just now, I was struck by what he said about compromising our cardiovascular systems as we get older, and how the 60-year-old in his MDMA safety study experienced some elevated blood pressure. What struck me was how my own relationship to MDMA has changed over the years. I won't recount here my early experiences with it during its heyday in Dallas as ecstasy, but what I want to mention is how my desire to use it began fading away several years ago, to the point where whenever I think about it now, my body says, "Are you really sure we should do this?" And now the answer always seems to be no. And what I'm getting at here is that by listening to my body, so to speak, I may have actually avoided an episode of elevated blood pressure, which, now that I'm in my 65th year, is something I'd like to avoid. So, for what it's worth, my advice in these matters is to always follow your instincts and not what your friends or your ego may be saying. You know, deep down you always know what's right for you at any given moment, and I found that when I trust those feelings over what my rational mind might be saying, I seldom go wrong. I was also taken with Charlie's comments about the scarcity of funding for psychedelic research. Fortunately, there have been a few individuals who are in a position to make significant donations to keep this research going. Quite frankly, without the very small number of big donors who fund this research, it probably would have come to a complete halt long ago. But for those of us who don't have any disposable income to help with this research, there are other ways we can help. You know, my way is to do it through these podcasts and try to spread the word about the importance of these sacred medicines as best I can. One of the things you can do if you feel so motivated is to tell a friend about the Psychedelic Salon and encourage them to take a look at the list of programs, of which, by the way, this is my 96th. And maybe they can see if there's a talk or two that would be of interest to them. And also, though you are small in number, I want to give a special shout-out to the 28 wonderful people who have made donations to keep the Psychedelic Salon going during these past 2 years. This coming Sunday, June 10th, is the second anniversary of this series of podcasts, and during that time, over tens of thousands of people have downloaded close to 1 million copies of these podcasts, not to mention the people who hear these programs through one of the mirror sites. So you wonderful 28 souls out there who sent contributions that range from $2 to $150 during the past 2 years, well, each and every one of you can rest assured that you have had a much greater impact in keeping these podcasts coming than you might really believe. Your generosity moves me deeply, and your encouragement is what keeps me going. And to all of you supporters of psychedelic research, on behalf of all of us, I want to thank you for keeping the psychedelic campfire burning. You know, unlike other areas of scientific interest, there aren't any big government grants going to the women and men who are called to investigate what may well be the most important class of chemical compounds we humans will ever encounter. It really makes you wonder what's so threatening about these substances to the keepers of the status quo that they go to such great lengths to keep them away from us. You know, just this morning I was listening to KMO's interview with Jacob Sullum on the Sea Realm podcast, and they were talking about how the U.S. Supreme Court has now approved 2 psychoactive sacraments for use in religious ceremonies, but that both of these syncretic religions involved aspects of Christianity. And that reminded me of a conversation I had with John Hanna a couple podcasts back, where he told us about the law prohibiting any reference to mind-altering properties that may be associated with energy drinks. You know, it's becoming more clear to me every day that what the screwheads in Washington are afraid of is losing their male-dominated, Calvinist Christian grip on the reins of power. And maybe they're right to see that if these psychedelic medicines were used in a conscious way by a culture such as the one Aldous Huxley described in his brilliant novel Island, a little of his moksha medicine might go a long way to nudging us humans up to a slightly higher level of awareness, particularly about what a mess some of our fellow humans are making of things on our dear little spaceship Earth. But hey, the news isn't all bad. You just have to dig a little deeper to find the good news. But there actually are a lot of reasons to hold on to our dreams of a global, sustainable, cooperative human culture. And if you're lucky enough to get to Burning Man this year, we'll have more to say about that when we meet again in the big tent on the playa. Before I go, I want to mention that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 2.5 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at www.psychedelicsalon.org. And if you have any questions, comments, complaints, or suggestions about these podcasts, well, just send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. Thanks again to Chateau Hayuk for our theme song here in the salon. And thanks again for being here. You know, it was nice to be with you again. And since I'm not quite ready to leave this nice vibe right now, I'm going to do something a little different. And as soon as I sign off, I'm going to play a song from my new favorite rock group, Vavohm, V-A-V-O-H-M, who, by the way, happen to be fellow Saloners. You know, about 6 months or so ago, I guess, they very kindly sent me their new album, and it really captured me. So a while back, I recommended them to Queer Ninja for one of his music programs, but right about then is when the Ninja began his sabbatical. So if you want to hear a little of the kind of music I like, I guess I'm going to have to play it myself. And now they've given me permission to use any of the songs on their new CD. And by the way, on the program notes for this podcast that you can find at psychedelicsalon.org, I'll put a link to the Vavohm site where you can find out a lot more about them. And although I asked if they had a preference for a song that I could play at the end of a podcast, they've pretty much left that up to me. So I'm not sure if they'll consider the song I'm about to play representative, but it's one I really enjoy. And so I'm going to sign off now and let you see if you can figure out what Vavohm's song titled Drifting Away might be about. So for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends. And now here is Vavohm, Drifting Away. Away.
Shall be